Okay, so, as in these director's talks to each one of the sessions, it's supposed to give one sort of overview of the field, which John did last week. And the other one's supposed to be on more theoretical issues, hopefully something of interest to theorists across fields. And in fact, what I'm going to talk about is not really so much a lattice talk. I mean, lattice, I won't certainly mention issues related to the lattice on the way. But it's a more general discussion of things that can happen in non-perturbative field theories. So what I want to discuss is two topics which at first seem rather different, but they're actually very deeply entwined. And one of them, I'm going to ask for what quark masses do you get spontaneous CP violation? Now, I should warn you at the beginning, this is not a very phenomenological issue. I'm going to be taking the quark masses into really crazy regimes, which have nothing to do with what their actual values are. My main motivation is to try to understand how chiral symmetry works in the strong interactions, or chiral symmetry works in general, with the hopefully the eventual goal of figuring out how to do it in the lattice for the weak interactions. But for the moment, this is kind of a theorist fantasy, wandering around with the strange eyes of the quark masses, and you'll see that rather rich stuff can happen. Then there'll be some kind of an interesting issue which will arise here, which is related to how do you really define the quark masses? I mean, an ordinary particle, the mass is defined by how it propagates over long distances, but quarks are confined. And what does the quark mass mean? So I'm going to give you a rigorous definition. And I'm going to argue that there are ambiguities in this definition, which are inherent, non-perturbative ambiguities. And so the second topic is going to be, I'm going to try to argue that statements such as the mass of the up quark equals zero have no physical meaning. In the sense that this will depend on the details of your renormalization scheme. Now, I'm going to make a couple of assumptions. I will assume that QCD, in fact, exists as a field theory, just to be a starting point. The quark confining dynamics exists. And confines. And I'm also going to build on the idea of effective chiral Lagrangians. So I'm going to assume that chiral Lagrangians are qualitatively correct. In the sense that they describe roughly the physics of the light through the scalar mesons. Now, actually, this is all I'm going to assume for most of this discussion. I mean, I will use the renormalization group, but it's okay. Okay, now, really, everything I'm going to say today is based on very old ideas. In fact, this first topic of how can quark varying the quark masses give you a CP violation was actually discussed by Dash in 1971. And actually, it's very nice to go back and look and read that paper again, because it's sort of before quarks were popular, but physics is in there. Devecchia and Veneziano, I'm trying to spell it right, D-I. This described this phenomenon, and also an interesting gap in the spectrum, which I'll be coming to later, in 1980. George I. and MacArthur In 81, discuss this fact that the concept of a zero mass quark can be ambiguous. And in fact, this paper was sort of a precursor to the very famous one of Kaplan and Menahar. I guess it was 86. Which showed, which argued that in the second Carroll Lagrangian theory, you can actually move the quark mass around into some higher order terms. And we're getting a little more recent now. Banks, Neer, and Seiberg in 94 also discussed this ambiguity in the up quark mass, but didn't push it quite as hard as I'm going to try to push it here. And then in 95, I actually wrote a paper doing essentially what I'm going to do today, but only for the two-flavor case. I'm going to concentrate on the three-flavor case here because there are certain simplifications, but everything I'm saying can be done for the two-flavor case. Okay, so if all this stuff is so old, why am I talking about it? Well, there's a couple of things which motivated me here. One is people in papers keep talking about MLP equals zero as a possible solution to the strong CP problem. And that always irritates me because this isn't definable. And therefore, how can it be a solution to that problem? Now, and it just bugs me when people talk about things which aren't well defined. I know with some theorists, especially nuclear physicists, you just have to accept the fact that they'll talk about things which aren't well defined. But, you know, it's less excusable for particle physicists.
This is being recorded.
Yeah, I am. And I think people know that was a joke.
You do work in a nuclear physics lab.
I do work in a nuclear physics lab. And I've been watching the people converting to nuclear physicists. Okay. But, you know, it really bugs me when lattice people think of things like this, because the lattice is a way of defining things rigorously, defining the field theory precisely. And they really should know better. There's a second reason I wanted to talk about this, and that is that, surprisingly, at least surprisingly to me, this is going to be very controversial. There are at least three people in this audience who have told me explicitly that they don't believe what I'm saying. There's probably people that haven't said it explicitly. And so, well, I haven't been convinced of this wrong, so. All right, so I'm going to start with the effect of Carroll Lagrangian theory for the pseudoscalar interactions. So I'm going to start by imagining I have some field sigma, the function at coordinates of space and time, which is itself an element of the group SU3. So I have a sigma model in space-time where my fundamental variables are elements of a group. And the three is coming about because I want to consider the three flavors. So I've got the up quark, the down quark, and the strange quark. And the connection between this SU3 matrix and the pseudoscalar meson fields, the usual thing. I write sigma in terms of the generator of the group, EI, pi, alpha, lambda, alpha. And then to get the units right, I need to put in some numerical constant, which is usually units. Is it 1 over f pi or f pi? 1 over f pi. So f pi is just a numerical constant. So lambda, alpha are the generators of the group. So those are the 8 Gell-Mann matrices. And the pi alpha are the pseudoscalar meson fields, which will be the functions of x. The connection between this and the underlying quarks is that sigma is supposed to correspond roughly to something like a psi bar left, psi right. And the matrix indices on sigma, it's a matrix up there, correspond to the flavor indices on these things. And the fact that psi bar psi is supposed to get an expectation value is manifested in the fact that sigma is supposed to get an expectation value in the vacuum. So that's the spontaneous breaking of chiral symmetry. Chiral symmetry is the fact that under a chiral symmetry rotation, I wouldn't be able to rotate these two fields independently. So it's essentially the same as taking sigma, some group element in the left dagger, some group element in the right. So these are independent global group elements. So this is symmetry is supposed to be spontaneously broken because sigma gets an expectation value. And it's also going to be explicitly broken by the quark masses, which I'll be explaining in a moment. So my starting point is an effective Lagrangian density, which is 4 pi squared. And then I'm going to take the trace of d mu sigma dagger d mu sigma. And then I'm going to add in the quark masses in the usual way. I mean, some numerical constant to get the units right. The real part of the trace of some mass matrix and sigma. And the mass matrix, I will work in a frame where it's diagonal. It's just M up and down and M stage. See about that. Okay, so this is my starting point. I know there's a lot of physics behind this. I hope I can take that high score before I got them. Well, that's not relevant. Okay. Now, one more conventional thing before I start becoming unconventional. You can take and plug this formula for the things in terms of the pion fields into this thing, expand it to quadratic order in the pion fields, plugging in this mass term, and you derive the famous formulas that you all know, that the masses of the pseudoscalars are proportional, the masses squared are proportional to the quark masses. So m pi plus Christian squared is proportional to m up plus and down. Now, what I want to concentrate on now is isospin violation. I'm going to let M up and M down be different from each other. And when you do that, isospin is not a good quantum number. So the pion and the eta will start to mix. The pi naught is no longer exactly a member of a triplet. So when you do this procedure of plugging this in there and taking the quadratic thing, you wind up with a matrix you have to diagonalize, which mixes the two. So for instance, what happens is the pi naught goes down a little bit and the eta goes up a little bit. And it's just solving a quadratic equation and just like on the answers. M up, M down, M strange, and then there's a mixing square root. Up squared plus M down squared plus M strange squared minus M up and down M up Strange, that's the third one. Okay, so this is kind of a messy looking formula, and don't care too much about the details. This is the mass of the pi naught, the eta just changes this minus sign to a plus sign. But now I'm going to get circling extreme. I'm going to take my up and down quark masses off to crazy values and ask, is it possible for this square root to cancel this to make the pi naught become massless? In fact, you can. If m up is equal to minus and down and strange over m down plus m strange. All these guys plug it in. Turns out at this point, the pi naught vanishes. An accidental vanishing, because you have to tune this mixing. And of course, higher order corrections and things will shift you a little bit away from this. But it is possible to make the pi naught mass vanish. But you know something kind of strange about it? There's a minus sign here, which means I've taken the quark mass negative. Now, naively, the sign of a quark mass is completely irrelevant. You take psi to gamma 5 times psi, you can flip the sign of your quark masses, make them all positive. Except that's an anomalous symmetry. And because of the anomaly, signs of the masses can become significant. To see this in a simpler case...
Just for saying, you can't make it so finance negative also.
Yes.
You can.
And that's what's going to be happening. If I go beyond this point, m pi naught squared becomes negative, the vacuum's unstable, the pion will get an expectation value. That's going to violate CP violation, and that's what I'm talking about here. Because it's CP unstable. Okay, so...
So this formula came
as
an assumption. What assumption?
I just took this here, plugged this into here, found the quadratic terms and expansions around the vacuum.
And diagonalized it.
And diagonalized the quadratic form. Okay, so... I kind of want to leave that. Let's, the usual case where all the masses are positive, this sigma field has quantum fluctuations about the identity matrix. Approximately the identity matrix. Supposing I took all three of my quarks, and this is the point which is the maximizer of the real part of the trace steps. Okay, so if I took all three of my quarks and let them be negative numbers, well, this isn't going to be my vacuum anymore, because what I really want is the minimum of the real part of trace of sigma. So you may say, okay, I want to have sigma approximately minus 1. There's a problem with that. That's not an issue here. So what does happen if I let all three of my quarks become negative in mass? Well, it's kind of instructive to look at the structure of SU3 in terms of what values of real trace, or what values of trace of sigma are allowed. So if I take the real part of the trace of sigma, and for general, SU3 matrices are constantly imaginary part. It turns out all SU3 matrices lie inside a region in this plane, which is bounded by matrices of the form E to the I theta lambda 8. And that's a funny shaped region. It starts out, well, 3, because we'll get the pick up 3. But it's a funny triangular shape like this. And if I ask for the minimum, there's two possible values for the minimum. And this occurs at sigma is equal to e to the plus or minus 2 pi I over 3. So in fact, there's two possible vacuum and all three quarks are negative in mass. Since Cp corresponds to taking sigma to sigma star, you see that either one of these vacuums is Cp non-invariant. If you will mix these two together. So Cp is being spontaneously broken when I pick one of these two vacuums. Now what I've done here is I'm trying to work my way back to that point by taking one of the quarks and half negative.
Mike, where have you put in that the symmetry is SU3 and not U3?
That was basically the extra Goldstone boson. Because it was U3, this would be a whole great big thing, and we know that's wrong, right? Because there would be a ninth pseudoscalar boson which would come into the game.
Yeah,
no,
is it someplace in the
boson?
Cross on the constraint
sigma. I've constrained sigma to be an SU3. You can go ahead and add in a eta prime in terms of adding a term to the effective Lagrangian involving the determinant. And that term will, there'll be additional mixing then, because there'll be mixing of eta prime as well. For the SU2 case, you actually have to take that into account. But for SU3, the eta is there to play this role.
I think the point is that you want to be rigorous, right? So you can still keep M up, down, and strain in principle much, much smaller than F5.
Yes, that's right. I mean, when the masses get large, you may worry about whether this effective Lagrangian is even right. Okay, so anyway, weird things like this can happen when the masses. And this equation here, in the M up, M down, defines a surface, which is a boundary for a phase in which the pi naught squared, where the pi naught gets an excitation value.
Question. So even if you keep the masses small, do you know that the effective Lagrangian is still good when you are getting such large
drafts
on it, for example?
First of all, you're always very close to this manifold SU3, and so there's no reason to expect it to fail. I know at least one person here thinks something will change will happen before I get to this point. But as far as the effect of Lagrangian, I think it's just the symmetries of the theory. So what happens as I pass through this point is that sigma is no longer approximately the identity. And with some quark, up quark mass a little bit more negative than that value there, sigma will become a complex matrix. Phi 1, phi 1. I can always still use flavor rotations to diagonalize it because I think my mass is diagonal. Instead of the SU3, it's this line inside. And so your vacuum fluctuates about a complex matrix, and the formula for these angles is M up sine theta 1 is equal to M down sine theta 2. Hold this right. Is equal to minus M strange sine theta 1 plus theta 2. Again, call them quiet here, theta 1 is inconsistent. And this has non-trivial solutions when this mass is away from that value. It gets more negative. You can actually, by analyzing this equation, you can show that it's a smooth transition, it's a second order transition. The excitation value of the pion goes smoothly to zero as you approach this point. And in general, there are two solutions relating to taking all the angles to minus themselves. It's the spontaneous breaking of CP symmetry. Okay, well, you can continue this game to explore more of the plane. Let me just draw a picture that summarizes the result. That was a good place. Look, I'll be back over here. Let me fix the strange court mass to be some positive number. It's going to be just how to fix. And let me study physics as a function of up and down court masses. Okay, in this plane, there is this curve. Up in this region here, sigma is fluctuating about 1, 1, 1. Now, if you flip the signs of two court masses, that's actually a good chiral symmetry. So if I can take both m up and m down to their negatives, I've got to have a reflection symmetry about this diagonal. So there's another curve here. Along with, and down here, sigma is approximately minus 1, minus 1, 1. And then there's two more regions. There's another boundary. The formulas for all the boundaries is by putting a plus and minus here, and a plus and minus here. And that's one point. So up here, sigma is approximately minus 1, minus 1. And down here, one minus one. But between these regions, it's an area where CT is spontaneously broken. And the point where all three quarks are equal and negative in mass is right in the middle of this. These asymptote at MS. Okay, now one minor lattice comment now. The lattice formulation such as Wilson fermions explicitly introduced another chiral symmetry breaking kind of interaction here. And so this precise structure becomes a little unstable. Aoki, well, for instance, this thing here can open up a little bit to give you a small CP violation even when up and down quarks are equal. That's called the Aoki phase. It's possible that the symmetry is broken in another way where these things, this pinches off to be a first order line. In fact, Steve Sharp has shown how that works, and so there's a possibility this becomes a first order, possibility it becomes a region of second order transitions. So when people talk about the Aoki phase, that's what it is. It's just an extension of this. Okay, a long time ago, Vathman and Witten wrote a paper saying you can't spontaneously violate parity in the strong interactions. However, that paper basically assumed the result because it assumed the fermion determinant was positive. If I start messing around with putting negative masses in here, the fermion determinant is not no longer positive. And so their theorem is actually quite irrelevant. I will talk more about theta later on, but effectively by going to negative court masses, I'm going to the region where theta is equal to pi. So this is pi out here.
Physically, how am I supposed to understand a negative quark mass? Is it just an abstract
parameter? There are these parameters you put into your Lagrangians, which are the quark masses. And since they aren't actually the masses of a physical particle, it's okay for them to be negative. And in fact, something like, you can have a bound state which gets a lot of energy from the gluonic fields. And then if I let the quark mass become negative, what that's going to do is actually subtract something from that mass. And so I like to think in terms of the eta prime. The eta prime has got some energy from the anomaly and everything. And if I let the quark mass become negative enough, I can actually make the eta prime become massless. They're just canceling off some of that energy.
What would that mean if I had a dense quark, a dense gas of quark, so that they were free?
But then there's going to be some sort of a scale in the problem, which is the distance between the screening length, the plasma length. And so this goes back to the, how do you define the quark, which will be the second half of the talk, which I think I'll have time to get through. Okay, now, let me take this picture here and hold both the strange quark and the bound quark mass states. Okay, so I'm going to follow some curve like this in this plane. And I want to study the physics as I vary just the up quark mass, the fixed down and strange quark masses. So one axis here is going to be the up quark mass. What am I going to do for another axis? Well, I'm going to want to be able to continue kind of around this funny region. And I'm going to do that by putting it in the imaginary part for the quark mass. So this becomes the real part. Again, you will see this is clearly related to a parameter called theta, which I'll bring into the discussion later. But the first thing you notice is that there's a gap. Nothing happens at zero, but at some negative value for the up quark mass, I enter this CP violating phase. And so what happens at that point is I get a first order transition ending at a second order endpoint. The order parameter is the expectation rate of pi naught field. And then when I get something large enough, like this thing lands. In fact, Vecchia and Veneziano in their 1980 paper pointed out both the gap and the existence of a CP violating phase. Now, the one question which immediately comes to mind, nothing's happening here at the origin. The planet is just getting lighter, perfectly analytic. How would I know I'm at this point? So it raises the question, is there any way to know that? Is there any significance to the point m up equals zero? When you know only physical things happen down here. And that's the second half of the talk. I'm going to try to argue that that's in fact an ill-posed question. Question when both the down and the strange quark are massive. So for that I'm going to have to get very precise about what I mean by a quark mass. But sort of the issue here is the concept of, you know, people come back and say, what about the mass that I put into my underlying Lagrangian? Well, there is no underlying Lagrangian. Field theory is full of divergences. You have to regulate it. It's only the symmetries of the problem which are significant. A single massless quark gives no special symmetry because of the anomaly. There are no exact Goldstone bosons at M equals zero. There's really no way to tell you there. So the point is that the continuum is not defined in terms of an underlying Lagrangian, it's defined as a limit of a cutoff theory. So for QCD, I have to take a limit. You don't need that there. Of my bare parameters. And so what are my bare parameters? This is bare coupling. And there's the bare mass. And I have to somehow, in the G and M plane, adjust my bare parameters to follow some trajectory to obtain a continuum limit at some critical point, which we'll see shortly lies at the origin. So this is some renormalization group trajectory. Both of those quantities actually were normalized to zero on the continuum limit. Now the way this works is very nicely described in terms of the renormalization group equation.
Wait, so M, you don't agree that M renormalizes multiplicatively?
Absolutely not. I'm going to say that.
But that's the standard.
That's the standard and it's wrong. You're jumping ahead. You're making a jump ahead here. Okay, so it's the famous renormalization group places. If I vary my, I'm going to use lattice language in terms of a lattice spacing A, but you can think of it in terms of one over a physical scale if you want, or some one over some large momentum column. Okay, so this is your usual beta function. This starts off with something.
The argument of
letters will be G. All right, I'm doing this. This is why I have to use the transparency. And so then there's this famous beta naught G squared, which our leader here is so famous for. And then G is a 4. Let's just do G. Plus, you can have some non-perturbative stuff here. Stuff which vanishes faster than any power of the coupling.
Wait, you have no problem with ambiguity in defining beta G?
Well, I will give you a precise definition of it in a moment.
You will pick one beta.
Yeah. And then I'm going to discuss changing that criterion.
But all this non-perturbative stuff is at the moment.
It's not going to play a big role here. It's going to play a big role in the next equation I'm going to write down. These first two coefficients are well known to be independent of scheme. The higher terms do depend on scheme, but we'll come to that. So then there's a similar equation. A, the bare mass, the A. Let me just drop these zeros because I'll carry them along. And so this is given by another function. G squared plus the right notation. Yeah. Plus non-perturbative. But again, the non-perturbative part goes to zero faster than any power. Gamma 0 is scheme independent, gamma 1 turns out to be scheme dependent, but we'll come to that later. Now, an important point, which I will be coming back to, is that this piece is not, in fact, proportional to M. That's the anomaly. Now, you all know how to solve these equations. You've all done it in your field theory classes. Let me just schematically write the answer.
Are you going to provide definitions?
Yes.
G and L.
Yes.
Before we talk.
At the moment, I'm just summarizing the canonical picture here. So this goes to 0 is 1 over the log of the scale. And you have to introduce some parameter to set the scale to affect the log of 1 divided by some lambda A. And this is asymptotic freedom. And M goes this some another, now lambda is an integration constant for integrating these equations. And it's another integration constant, which is going to be my renormalized quark mass. And this goes as 1, the log, 1 over lambda A, raised to a power, and the power is beta, gamma naught over beta naught. So anyway, this goes to 0 logarithm of the continuum limit, and so does this. So that just like this qualitative sketch, so I've got to follow some trajectory down. Now these two things, lambda and m, are integration constants. Lambda is what we normally call the QCD scale. And for my purposes, I'll say that M is my new normalized port mass. Okay. They're both finite in the continuum limit. The specific detailed numerical values of these things do depend on steam, and that's well understood. Okay, so let me get more precise about how I define beta and gamma. What I really mean is that I want to find some physical quantities which I hold fixed as I keep adjusting my bare parameters to hold those physical quantities fixed. And so that's how you define this thing. So what am I going to use for my physical quantities? Well, what could be more physical than particle masses? So for instance, the mass of the proton, mass of the lightest baryon in the theory. And then for the quark masses, you want to bring in the pseudoscalar mesons, which is the most natural thing to do. So something like the mass, I'll call this mass of pion, the lightest pseudoscalar boson, if I only had the two couplings. Now if I had several quarks in the theory, then I have to add enough additional pseudoscalar mesons to get all the quark masses. But let me just consider one really light quark, and so that we'll be talking about just the pion mass for simplicity.
Well,
let me kind of sketch the direction I'm going.
No, but is that true?
What I'm going to do is define everything precisely. Then I'm going to say, now what happens when I change schemes? And I'm going to show you that there exists a scheme for which the quark mass vanishes, no matter what the quark mass you start off with is. You can always make it zero, and therefore it has some meaning. Maybe I should get there.
So what about defining quark mass by quark mass?
There's no pole. It's confinement. Quarks don't exist.
To me, it looks like the real issue you have to prove your point that there is no physical reasonable definition that would single out a zero mole.
Yeah, you're saying what I'm going to try and say.
But that's a very tall order, because whatever you're doing, restricted by the choice you're making right now.
I'm, at the moment, I have in mind a particular way of cutting off the theory. Then I'm going to ask the question, what happens if I have another way of cutting off the theory? How can I relate the two? How do I match the schemes? And so there's an ambiguity in that matching. But we should let me do it. So these things here, these things in general are functions of what I've got to cut off in the theory and the bare parameters. Both of these. So I can go off and I do whatever my non-perturbative calculation is for a given value of the cutoff, or the given value of the bare thing, and a given value of the bare mass. And I find out what my proton mass is, and I get some number. And so my normalization group scheme is to hold those things fixed. So A, B, or any one of the masses, dA, is supposed to be zero. Okay, so that's A, the partial of the mass, with respect to the first argument, plus the second argument, G, then dG dA, and A dG dA is beta. And the bare mass, let them gamma with it. Okay, now, in the case where I just have one quark, say, then I've got, these things are enough to completely fix it. This is just a linear equation in beta and gamma, and so I can define beta and gamma by solving it. So once I know these functions, I know beta and gamma precisely. and I don't think I'll write that down. One nice thing about this definition, it's got nothing to do with any gauges. It's got nothing to do with any perturbation theory. It's just a definition. It's a dull non-perturbative effect, too. Okay, so if I get done with this game, I will find the d squared will go to zero like this, and then we'll go to zero like that with some general analysis. And so I will discover that I will have, given some particular physical values for these, I will discover the numerical values for these two parameters. So lambda is a function of the physical masses I put in. So for instance, the mass of the photon, using my prediction, and the mass of the pion. So given a particular physical value for the proton and pion, I will get these numbers. Now I can turn this whole thing around and write this the other way around. Let's invert that and imagine for any given PCD scale and any given quark masses, I can calculate what proton and pion are. I can think of that as a function of lambda n. And from just simple dimensional analysis, everything here is dimensions of masses. So these particles will have to have a form of something like lambda. I have some function, which will depend on the particle I'm looking at, of lambda over lambda. Well, that's just perfectly general. Now, supposing we're doing a multi-flavor theory. Supposing we have double quarks. Then, when I take the quark mass to zero, I expect to have Goldstone bosons. And so I expect m pi squared to go as the quark mass. So therefore, I expect for the multi-flavor theory that this function, whatever it is, has a square root singularity. You get the usual Goldstone bosons. The existence, the location of this square root singularity removes any ambiguity in defining what I mean by the quark mass. The quark mass is defined to be the point where the square root singularity is. So that's simple enough. But what about the one-flavor theory? Now, the one-flavor theory has no chiral symmetry. It has no Goldstone bosons. M pi equals zero doesn't occur at m equals zero, but occurs at some negative mass. So in the one flavor theory, this function, f of x, well, it has a zero, some negative value for the quark mass. But in general, it should give you a smooth behavior as x is away from the origin. Okay, so now let me draw a sort of a qualitative picture. An important point is that these terms here are not, in fact, proportional to the quark mass. And you can see that intuitively, if you like instantons. I didn't like putting this in my original paper, but I got forced into it eventually. If you have something like an instanton occurring, it induces something called the Tuff vertex, which is related to the anomaly. It says that every species of quark flips its spin when the instanton occurs. So I can have an up quark coming in, that's turning into an upright. Down quark coming in, it's into a down right. And strange coming in. That's to put this thing through. Now I'm considering the case where the down and the strange quark have inherent masses of their own. And qualitatively, I can imagine joining these together with a mass of strange quark insertion. I can take the two down quarks, put them together with a mass of the down quark insertion. And you see what I've done is I've actually generated an effective mass-like term for the upper quark. Now this, in this case, it's proportional to M, S, and D. Although in generically, if I let these quarks become very, very massive, it can also be determined of order lambda QCD. Look at the smaller of those. Because terms like that will come into here, that means that M equals zero is not a renormalization group invariant concept. If I start with M equals zero, follow this whole procedure, M will start to drift away from zero. All right, so now let me talk about trying to match between two different renormalization group schemes. Supposing somebody gives me one way of cutting off this theory with Wilson fermions and somebody else is doing it with overlap fermions or whatever. In general, I want to be able to match these two schemes. I want them to, in the zero coupling limit, to approach the same classical theory. So in other words, what I want, so I've got some new scheme with a d tilde. It should equal the old scheme, g, to lowest order.
And then
it can have higher order corrections. Same thing with the mass. We can define a new mass, which should equal the old mass. Times things times 1 plus order g squared. Plus non-perturbative stuff. And this non-perturbative stuff should vanish faster than any power of the coupling constant. You just gotta have g to the minus 1 over g squared, so instantons. Okay, so this matching should occur if I take the coupling constant to 0 at some fixed scale. Now, doing this at a fixed scale is in fact not the continuum limit. G goes to 0 at fixed lattice spacing is perturbation theory. G goes, if I take the lattice spacing to 0 without varying G, then you've got all the divergence of field theory. The continuum limit occurs that corresponds to taking both A and G together along this renormalization group trajectory, which I've erased. So let me just, following these rules, let me give you a new scheme, which is it's obviously cooked up, but let me define a new scheme where I keep the lattice spacing the same. And just for fun, I'll keep the G the same. But I'm going to let the mass tilde be different. Okay? So the mass is going to start off as the old mass. And I'm going to add something non-perturbative to that. Cheat. So I'm going to take the bare quark mass from my original scheme. I know that for the normalization group, whatever mass I use must go to zero with its appropriate perturbative behavior. So it must go as my d tilde to the minus gamma zero over beta naught. So that hasn't done anything yet. So now I got to multiply this from something which is going to go to zero faster than any power of g.
Yeah. You don't care about the
multiplicity. Well, either the minus 1 or g squared is better
than non-analytic. Anyway.
When you're mapping schemes, if you just map between schemes.
I'm going to map between schemes in a way which satisfies this equation.
All I said is that the map from the g to g tilde, which preserves the values of beta naught and beta 1 and doesn't preserve the other values,
true.
The map is assumed to be analytic. Now, the same thing, but may extend to F. we decided,
yeah.
So you have two coupling of.
So this is not going to change gamma naught, which is not supposed to. These higher order terms can change gamma one, but
I was asking, M to it looks to me nominally dependent on G.
Yeah.
So what I'm asking, is that by your rules of the game?
My rules of the game is they better go to
you
zero.
You can make whatever rules.
I haven't multiplied it by. I'm going to multiply it by something which goes to zero faster than any power of the coupling.
So you are breaking analyticity. Just that's my point. That's all.
Sure. The non-perturbative stuff is not in there. So I'm going to multiply this time something which goes to zero faster than any power. I'll take it to be 1/2. Maybe not g squared. Over g squared. I'm sorry. 1 divided by 2 greater than half g squared. And just for fun, I'll put an extra power of g here. And I'm going to divide this by, set the scale lambda. That's a lattice space. Now, if you remember the definition of lambda is in fact this whole combination. So this combination goes to 1 in the limit of following the normalization group trajectory to the new limit. So my M, I renormalize, new renormalized mass, which is defined to be the limit of as A goes to 0, the M tilde times removing this perturbative factor, well, the first piece just goes to M. The second piece, I've clipped it up, so this all goes to 1, this goes that, minus M, so 0. So here is a cooked up scheme where my renormalized mass vanishes, regardless of what my original mass was. Now, you do this for the top quark, this is going to be a huge non-perturbative correction, and it doesn't really make any sense to do it. But in principle, you can do it.
But I could do it for G and make beta naught
zero. No, beta naught is these so conditions are enough to keep beta.
If I change G in a non-analytic way, maybe beta naught, I can beta naught for sure. I bet you I can make zero as a non-analytic because what has happened in the condo.
You can certainly make beta 1 zero. Yeah, you make beta 1 zero without even doing any of this non-perturbative stuff. I mean, that's my favorite. I mean, that was just one term. But within these rules, you cannot.
Yeah,
no, they do not.
We nevertheless say that beta 1 is an invariant.
I'm sorry, not beta 1, beta 2. I'm sorry, beta 2. Beta 9 and beta 1 are fixed because they're just basically this. It comes into one of these formulas. Beta 1 appears here, so I've cooked that up so that's in grant. No, I think you can't do more than this.
Not by any terms that
the proof that beta naught and beta 1 are independent are
allowing non-referencing
not really, because there's a lambda downstairs. Normally in your scheme you have G's and A's. You can't put lambdas in. This is a deception because you put it in specific lambda in there.
Lambda is just a number.
Well, no, it's not. It's dependent on G and A. So you're
No, lambda doesn't depend on G and A. Lambda depends upon
the. It does. Because it cancels the numerator, so it does depend on G and A. It's
okay. I mean, the thing is,
you've really written it in a deceptive way. And you know, if you were talking about fixed needle lattice spacing, you would not ever talk about lambda. You put in 1 over lambda, which is a huge number on the scale of the lattice spacing.
I'll obviously cook this up.
It's more than, yeah, it's okay. If you talk about measurement and neural data spacing, it's extremely unnatural because you've got a 1 over
it's
lambda.
He's trying to make a point which I don't regard as surprising, given the non-perturbative effects which don't vanish when you turn off the quark masses, affect the quark masses, that you can make a definition for the normalized quark mass in one flavor case where there's no symmetry. Come out to be zero. He's just trying to make a mathematical point. It's not a natural definition.
No, there's another point though, which is that when the cutoff is small, these non-perturbative effects are small, and there should be some sense in which they go away.
And they do.
Which is lost to this definition.
No, it isn't. They're in, well.
Which is lost.
M tilde still goes to zero in an appropriate way. Oh, let me, since I'm. What are the parameters?
If you can set one of the normalized masses to zero by fiat, then the original description that you had counted a certain number of parameters, and one of them disappeared.
That's because I picked a peculiar scheme, and the other parameter is the scheme.
What kind of scheme you picked, you can't change the number of physical parameters.
Your parameter is 2. It's always 2.
Where's the other one?
One is the chord mass, and one is the bare coupling. Now, this says that in this particular scheme, it corresponds to a particular value for the chord mass. You can make it vanish. But it's still, it's basically
so you're
two parameters.
Saying that if you changed the bare chord mass and then kept the scheme fixed, you would have a renormalized mass in that scheme.
Yeah. I think that's the thing. All right, so since I'm running on kind of late, let me make some lattice remarks.
I think that what we need is just one definition which singles out the value m equals 0.
That's what I would like
just
somebody to tell me.
Well, I tell you, solve QCD in a very tiny volume. Then instant of induced mass will behave as a function of the volume.
Yeah, but that depends on the volume.
Which will not happen for any other value of the fourth mass.
It's like, go to smaller and smaller volumes, the effects of the number of things get smaller and smaller. But you're avoiding the problem is that I want a precise definition that doesn't depend on any small parameter.
No, it's an ultraviolet issue. Mm-hmm. So I'm allowed to put the system in a volume.
Right.
And I'm allowed to say that volume measured in number QCD is 10 to the minus 5.
Sure.
And then I'm allowed also to vary that parameter. And then I can ask, what is the mass of the lowest mesor? How does it depend on that volume?
Now you've introduced a new parameter, which is your volume.
It's very physical, only observable things. And in the case that I will declare that the bare quark mass was 0, if I see a mass dependence of the lowest mesor state, which is one instanton dominated, which will be a power dependence on that volume.
Okay, this is an argument.
How are you going to isolate a one meson state if you made the universe have a dimension which is 10 to the minus 5 times the...
Well, I still can solve for the spectrum.
Okay.
How do you define the spectrum?
It is an H diagonalizer.
Okay, I'm not
exactly.
Going to get very much further if I don't just give me a few lattice remarks since we're running late here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
It's a space volume, but that's enough for component instant.
Yeah. Well, there are still non-potential corrections due to the
instant.
They get smaller and smaller.
Right.
But they are still there at any finite choice of your small volume.
Right.
That's right.
Right. And any other mass that I put into my dungeon will not give me a power. Mm-hmm. So that's it's an operational definition. Maybe it's not pretty. I agree that there is nothing miraculous about
that. Let me go on, because we've argued about this before, and I don't think I just wanted to say a few things about the lattice. First, the definition of a quark mass depends upon my details on my lattice action, of course. You can use Wilson fermions, you can use staggered, Lehmol, whatever you want. And of course, when there's no reason that the non-perturbative effects are the same with all these definitions. Now, the overlap is kind of interesting because it seems to have a bit of chiral symmetry in it. When you go down to one flavor, it's not entirely how it works, but the point I'd like to make is the overlap is not a unique, there's no unique overlap. It depends upon the particular operator you use to generate it. So there's an input mass which goes into the Wilson thing. So if the bare quark mass doesn't depend on that, you're okay. But I see there's no reason it shouldn't. And the Ginsberg-Wilson relation says nothing about that. That by itself does not say that the quark mass is invariant under going from one overlap to another. Topological susceptibility enters the game now, because if a quark is massless, topological susceptibility vanishes almost by definition, since there's a factor of the determinant which suppresses it. So the question is topological susceptibility a well-defined thing when I have rough gauge fields around? Now, perturbatively, it seems to be. Giusti, Rossi, Tessa, and then later Lucier showed that there were no perturbative infinities to be seen. Now, what about non-perturbative things? Again, the topological charge of a lattice configuration, if I use the overlap operator, depends upon this Wilson parameter. You can make it not depend on that by assuming the gauge fields are smooth through what's called an admissibility condition, where plaquettes are not allowed to get too far from the identity. However, you can prove that if I impose that condition, my theory is not reflection positive. So it makes you really worry about it. And I would say that topological susceptibility has inherent ambiguities, just like this, when there are less than two flavors. I was going to make some remarks on theta. I'm also saying here that theta has a small ambiguity in this definition because the real part of the quark mass has a small ambiguity. But I think I'm kind of late. Let me just close with what I think is an interesting thing to think about. You can always rotate theta between the various, it's the phase of the determinant of the quark matrix. And you can move it by favored color rotations into any quark I want. So let's put all of, supposing we had a non-zero theta, let's put all of that phase on the top quark. If I put it all on the top quark, how can the complex top quark mass affect low energy physics given a dipole moment to the neutron? And I think if you kind of understand how that works, you kind of understand what I'm talking about here. Thank you.
May I make some comment? So you were concentrating on the expectation value of a supported parameter of Q bar gamma phi Q.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think there is another important order parameter, which is just the expectation value of the sign of the determinant. And I think this defines you, first of all, if it is not one, then there is CP violation, or spontaneous CP violation, and the point where this happens defines uniquely the zero
quark. Okay, now I would say that that point where that happens depends on the details of which action you use.
Yes, of course.
And particularly, if I don't use overlap, it's not a precise point. If I use overlap, it's a precise point, but I would say that if I change my overlap definition, it will be a slightly different point in terms of the physical parameter space.
It will not depend, I mean, this is of course what I'm saying is just me, and I cannot prove it, but the physical parameter will not depend in the continuum limit. It is always be whatever you take, Wilson action, overlap action, another overlap action, there will be always a uniquely defined point. If you go to the continuum limit in this point, you get a well-defined theory, always the same.
Okay, well, I'm saying that that is a conjecture, and nobody has proven it, and Ginsburg-Wilson does not require that. And that's basically all I'm saying. Until you can actually prove that, why should I believe it?
It would be difficult to prove. So I'm also saying that this is just a belief. But at least I think one thing which can be, which could be numerically checked, is exactly this behavior. You just look for the sign of the determinant, whether it is, you know, has an expectation of one or for smaller than one, and then this is a singularity of on your quark mass axis. And now, if you don't want to identify this singularity with the zero quark mass, this is possible. But I say that this is just a very natural
definition
to identify this point to the zero quark mass.
Now, that's a real challenge for the lattice simulations, to actually show that this is, in fact, independent of which quark action you take. I say there's no reason for it to be. But it might be, and if it is, then maybe there's something wrong with what I'm saying. But it definitely is not required by any fundamental principle to be unique.
But in order to really escape the lattice situation, you need to appeal to the absence of reflection positivity at some point. Because at some point, that's what you're
saying.
And that's probably your goal.
That's right. Yes.
Now, first of all, we are using non-reflection positive actions.
I know in practice we are all the time.
Yeah. Second of all, there is a multitude of definitions of what it means by reflection positivity. It's not one. Mm-hmm. And somebody put a pen in the middle, somebody uses three planes in order to make it. So the fact that in one definition...
It doesn't prove it doesn't exist, but it does say that there's no reason for it.
The question is, who is the burden? I think the burden is... The burden is... because you are
non-conscious. No, I'm saying if you haven't proven something, why should I believe it? Unless you can prove that there's some reason for topological susceptibility to be well-defined, why should it have to be well-defined?
There's a lot of data that has been gotten for on lattices that you can discover.
Sure, but data has got errors and fluctuations and anything else.
But you see, you will find an argument for everything. My point is really, who has more burden of proof?
I'm saying you have not shown this to me, and therefore I'm not going to believe it. That's all. Nobody has shown me the topological susceptibility does not have ultraviolet problems. Okay.
Right, so you like, we haven't proven that QCD exists.
Yeah, okay, that's one level. I assume that at the beginning. I'm assuming it exists, and even if it exists, there's no reason why topological susceptibility has to be well defined.
Yeah, but the level of your arguments, again, in support, the fact that you have to appeal to the reflection positivity in one definition for this action which binds the packet value. It's such a level of nitpicking which is almost equal to saying that you don't believe that QCD exists.
No. QCD could exist perfectly consistent if the normalization flows are all correct. I'm just saying you're asking for additional properties of QCD which have no need to exist. And if you can prove it exists, that's wonderful. But nobody has proven the topological susceptibility is finite. Reflection positive, something has to go wrong if I'm right.
I understand.
And I've narrowed it down to reflection positivity. But I'd like somebody to show me that I'm wrong in a way which is really convincing. Yeah.
I have a question. Normally we think of the fermion zero mass being zero, being very naturalist because of technical naturalist, right?
Well, yeah.
So how should I think about this in this context? You're saying there's always some non-perturbative ambiguity in there? It's just maybe a small number, but just theoretically.
The ambiguity is something of order lambda QCD, which is a finite thing. I guess that would be very good. It's natural up to something of the order of the scale of the theory that you're working
in terms of continuum languages, is that saying that the Yukon coupling, the parameter, has some non-perturbative ambiguity from QCD sector, or?
Well, the coupling is perfectly well defined.
Yeah.
It's the mass of things, an additive shift.
The mass is just, the coupling, Yukawa coupling times the expectation values.
In terms of the Yukawa coupling, yeah, right. It's the same thing. The Yukawa coupling has...
Exactly.
If you're coming from grand unification, It's the Yukawa coupling is, again, not protected from non-perturbative shifts.
Oh.
An additive shift, yeah.
Okay, that's my final.